are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Uncle Dig?
Hey, it's been a busy morning, but it's going good down here in Southern Oregon. How about you, Lucas?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good. I'm glad to hear you're doing well. And I just wanted to take a minute this show to introduce ourselves again, because I know we have some new listeners on our blog, and we're also getting some new people listening to 101.9 LPFM in Tacoma and 95.3 KTQA LPFM here in Tacoma. And also, we're in the Tacoma Public Library, so I know there's some people listening there as well. And so, just wanted to take a second just to let the audience know who is up here on the radio talking to them about cannabis. So just take a minute and introduce yourself to our audience, Dig.
Yeah, Lucas. So I'm currently a medical cannabis activist. I'm currently a medical cannabis patient. But as a younger man, I wasn't really involved in cannabis to any great degree. I was actually in the Army. I was in the Army for just shy of 8 years. And then when I got out of the Army, like a lot of veterans, I was faced with the choice of using opiates to treat chronic pain or experimenting with cannabis. And I chose to experiment with cannabis instead of taking opiates. At that time, the VA was making veterans sign pain contracts. I don't know if some people remember those. I'm not going to get into those too much. But basically, when you signed it, they would drug test you. And if you came positive for any other drugs like cannabis, they would discontinue your pain medication immediately. So I didn't want to sign one of those. So I started using cannabis, and shortly thereafter, I started participating in the Oregon medical cannabis scene, helping other growers working in their gardens from, I would say, the mid-2010s to currently. And I also started growing at home in 2016, and I've been an Oregon medical marijuana patient since the mid-2010s.
Yeah, and you and I first met, you were in Tacoma, and we met at a march. You saw me, we were at People's Park, and I was tapping across the park, and I remember I kind of did a couple stumbles there, as I usually do. And Audience Dig actually came up to me and said, "Hey, sir, would you like some help?" And Dig helped me all the way through the march. We walked all the way down through downtown Tacoma. He led me all the way through, and we kind of struck up a friendship. He gave me a ride home. And then it was a couple years later, we sort of started talking again on Facebook. And by that time, you had started growing cannabis. I've been in the cannabis since the 90s. I was a medical cannabis patient when I was 19 in Alabama. Have lots of interesting stories about getting cannabis in Alabama, the police, roadblocks. Very kind of interesting and really traumatic issues with cannabis in my early ages. But now I'm a medical cannabis patient and I'm a medical cannabis activist. I do writing for Ganjapreneurs and am really happy to be on the Cannabis Corner here with Uncle Dig. So really glad you're on the show, Dig.
Yeah. I'm glad I ran into you during Occupy.
Yeah, that was really great. I just want to remind the audience that you can go over to YouTube at The Cannabis Corner and find our first three seasons if you're wondering where those are. And Dig comes on about episode 20. I think that's right, Dig.
Yep. I think that sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, but we've been doing this together since right about the time the pandemic started is when we started co-hosting together.
Yeah, that sounds right. We've been doing it for quite a while.
Yeah, and I just wanted to let the audience know that coming up later for our guests, we have Chuck Olivier. And Chuck is the owner-operator of Digital Balance Services, and he works with weights and measures in the cannabis industry and has some really interesting insights on what's coming down on the federal level when it comes to weights and measurements in the cannabis industry. So stay tuned. And now, let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa Special Report.
And what we're going to do first before we get into some news around the country is we're going to stick here in our home state where we're broadcasting from here in Washington. And we are going to do a legislative update with a couple bills that we feel like folks should keep an eye on. And I feel most of them, except for the last one we're going to talk about, we really hope that they pass and might need a little fixing to work on them, but in the concept of these bills, we really hope these are going to move forward. And the first one is the one that we're always pushing here on the Cannabis Corner and other places, is our home grow bill. That's HB 1614. And this plant, this bill allows people to grow 6 plants at home, but I know they've been doing a little work on it, so it's kind of changed over the years, Dig.
Yeah, I read some things, and I started reading the actual bills. Some of them are hard to find via Google. You've got to actually go onto Washington's website, as Lucas showed me. And so I've got the PDFs pulled up, and each one is pretty long. But I went through them, and I kind of saw some things, as particularly in this home grow bill, that while aren't like super concerning, do provide some pause. The first thing that I see out of the gate in the home grow bill that's going to become a problem is the limit. The limit of possession seems to be 1 pound, but you can have up to 6 plants. If you're growing 6 plants outdoors, 1 pound is too low of a limit.
Yeah. Yeah, that could add to some problems if somebody shows up and is like, how much cannabis do you have?
Right, and this also causes a problem for Washington, right? If you want to prevent diversion, and it does seem like this makes it legal to give people weed, but that's a whole other part of the law that we don't need to talk about. But the law states that you can have the product of 6 cannabis plants, but then only up to 1 pound. So what this tells me is that the state expects you to give away all your cannabis besides the last 1 pound. And I don't see how the state thinks this is going to prevent diversion. Because remember, Washington is always giving lip service to trying to prevent diversion. But this 1 pound limit makes it to where diversion is almost... they're making it almost have to happen because of this absurdly low limit. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And there was something else I saw that you can't have your cannabis plant grown in public, and they were going to have some kind of penalty if you were caught with your cannabis plant being seen outdoors growing.
And yeah.
So I didn't really think that was a great idea. But the problem is the prevention community's been really active in Washington and across the country. And so some of this in the home grow bill is trying to placate some of the concerns around kids' access to cannabis and kids around cannabis and things like that. So we'll see if the home grow bill passes. It's been getting really close. And the next thing we want to talk about is a bill that just started popping up last year, kind of inspired by the things that are going on in Oregon and Colorado, and that is a psilocybin bill. But like Oregon and unlike Colorado, it just sets up a thing where it's like a system with the psilocybin service center. So if you have a traumatic event, you can go in, similar to like a ketamine clinic. And what... did you take out a looking at that bill, Dig? And then I'll share a couple things I came away with while watching the hearing.
Sure. So one of the first things I want to point out about this law is that it says nothing about children. It actively prevents children from accessing the service. So any concerns about anyone over 21 having access to psilocybin, or, you know, you want that to happen, that medical care will not be provided to children. So it's a non-issue. Something else that I saw that irked me a bit is that they made sure to carve out to where they wouldn't require insurance companies to pay for it. It looks like any recipient of a federal grant, et cetera, is allowed to disallow this for their people. So no colleges, no state-funded hospitals. I'm sure this has implications for nonprofits. And also there's another stipulation in here about federal contracts that basically makes it impossible for anyone living in public housing probably to access this. And there's some question about HUD vouchers as well. So they're basically making this harder to access for poor people. They're also making sure in this law that compliance with federal law enforcement is going to be mandatory. So there's always the possibility that the state will set this up and then rat everybody out because they're not protecting anyone.
Yeah, so the number on the bill is SB5263 if people want to take a look at that. And I have concerns, too, where they're really trying to lock it down, it seemed to me, in the hearing. But the good news was is that a lot of legislators were open to listening, and they had some questions. And the hearing went on for like 45 minutes. They had a lot of doctors coming in. There was a doctor that said that they were doing a study with frontline nurses and healthcare workers with psilocybin and things like that. So there's a lot going on out there that we don't really know about with this. But I really, they also want to have like mushroom traceability, which right. I think is kind of those two words.
Why would we waste money trying to trace mushrooms when we can't even trace the cannabis moving around in the state?
Yeah, they brought up the cannabis traceability system, one of the people on the committee. And, I was just thinking in my head, like, that doesn't even work.
Jim McRae has come on this show, a very talented statistician, and explained to us in great detail, irrevocably, that the state is doing a bad job or no job at tracking its cannabis. So any traceability that the state says they're going to do is a red herring, because they're not going to be able to do any of it because they're incapable of setting up a system that actually works.
And there's a lot of licensing issues where they're going to make all these licenses, but you know they're going to probably limit the number. They're going to be costly. They were paying a lot of lip service to social equity and things like that. There was mention of like a micro type business, but they they put a lot of work in this bill to make it restrictive. I thought it was like,
yes, they did.
There was like the place has to have a border and a set place and all these different things to really make it like, well, you can't take it to somebody's house and give it to them and things like that. So I'm
there's
not
one
sure
more
how
thing I wanted to point out here in this bill, because I read a lot of it and I went down to section 59, and this is probably the thing that made me the most mad, because remember, this is 21 and over. Section 59 states a person may not make a licensee may not maintain a noisy, lewd, disorderly, or insanitary establishment. Okay, now noisy, lewd, disorderly are all subjective. I would argue that lewd shouldn't even be here. It's a 21 or older establishment.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a Puritan insert into a law that's a medical law. The people who put this in here are children, and they shouldn't be allowed. This is like something you'd read in like a church rules or something. This doesn't belong in rules for a medical organization, and it's very troubling that this made it in there.
Yeah, that is troubling. But it's Washington State. They're a bit puritanical up there. It's it's interesting politics here in Washington State. But the next one we're going to move on to is one that we really hope passes, and that is the medical cannabis tax break bill. As the audience knows, Washington State has the highest medical cannabis tax in the country, 37%, and almost only one of the only ones that has a medical cannabis tax, like Mississippi. You have Republicans in Mississippi saying, nope, we don't want to tax medical cannabis because the people are sick. But here in Washington, 37% tax, and that bill, what's the number on that bill, Dig?
Patient tax break, HB 1453.
Yeah, so we're really hoping that passes, so we'll go and take a look at that. There is also a medical cannabis patient arrest protection law. It'd be 10 minutes for me to explain how all that works, but there is a loophole in the law that even if you have a medical cannabis authorization, you still can get arrested and get your plants taken and your whole grow set up and everything, and actually have to go to court and prove yourself innocent and all these different things. Even if you have a medical cannabis card, that is trying to be fixed. But then there's one more bill that we want to talk about real quick, and that is SB 5405. That is giving the Liquor Control Board, Liquor and Cannabis Board, more subpoena power. Guess what they're trying to subpoena, Dig? Power bills.
Seriously, we're just going to do the war on drugs in a legal framework? It's so dumb, Washington. So dumb.
Yeah, I was kind of blown away by that. And props going out to the two black men who showed up and testified against it. I wish I would have known that the bill was there. And I was really shocked that there were some pretty heavy-hitter cannabis groups around that remained silent on that And SB5405, yeah, I mean, the police.
Do you have SWAT teams in the Tacoma area?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We have a,
okay, so you
have a
no
SWAT
knock
rental
rate.
Service.
So this doesn't just endanger cannabis users. This endangers all home gardeners. Because people don't know this. Most, like, at-home horticultural lighting isn't used to produce cannabis. It's used to jumpstart spring planting. And in Washington, it's incredibly important if you want to grow vegetables that you have a light and a greenhouse to do it in. So this is going to wrap up. People are going to get subpoenaed that have nothing to do with cannabis. And it's not good. This is going to waste a lot of law enforcement resources. This is bad. There's so much horticultural lighting in Washington State that has nothing to do with cannabis. And this is going to wrap up. This is going to be very bad.
Yeah, I do know people who grow microgreens inside. And on this, too, like, the police have the subpoena power to go and get a subpoena and check your power bill, like the police. But the Liquor and Cannabis Board are not the police. So it's not like this thing can't happen. But I think the police have bigger things to do than go and poke around at the power company looking to see how many lights you have on at your house. So just check that out, SB5045. I was quite shocked that they even put that up there. And I'm hoping it does not pass.
So, that's a huge step back. We're going to start reading about those horror stories about cops shooting dogs over basement tomato gardens. Y'all are being really bad.
So speaking of really bad, we're moving on to our next story. And that is the FDA. After all the hype, all the waiting. I was just on the Hemp and Food Task Force. There was a lot of talk about what the FDA was going to do. We have the Epidiolex thing where the FDA has already regulated that. The FDA finally said, hey, we don't have the tools, quote, the toolbox, to actually regulate CBD. And we're going to kick this football back over to the legislative branch. Because the FDA is in the executive branch, they kicked it back over to the Congress and said, hey, Congress, you're the one that has to do something about this. And you really had a good point and some concerns about this, Dig. What's going on with this?
Well, you know, I was reading this article and, you know, normally I'd be like, okay, fine, FDA, you're not interested, fine. I don't care. But something that the FDA Deputy Commissioner, Dr. Janet Woodcock, said actually concerned me. She said that studies have shown CBD has the potential to harm the liver, interact with certain medications, and harm the male reproductive systems. And you brought up the point, of course, that this is normal, you know, reefer madness stuff. And these are talking points of reefer madness. However, they're making a decision not to investigate this further. So they found a place where the supplement may be dangerous, specifically in the high concentrations you're seeing in artificial supplements. And now they're choosing to kick the football down the road. And that makes me concerned, because that means they're seeing a possible danger and they're not investigating it. And I would ask the listener to ask themselves why that is. Why are they not investigating whether or not CBD is harmful to the user? And I would argue that the federal government doesn't concern itself with the safety of cannabis users. You see this in a number of ways where we don't get equal protection under the law. The Second Amendment, some would argue the First Amendment, definitely the Fourth Amendment. And now in this case, the government isn't even taking the time to protect us from medicines that may be harming us.
Yeah, and then now that I think that the CBD also includes the Delta 8s and all that too. I think they just kicked it all out because that all comes from CBD. But even if we're just talking about CBD, I picked out those words too, and it's very concerning that, let's say that CBD does harm the liver in a large amount, and they have studies for that. I haven't seen a ton of that or heard much about that, but let's say the FDA has them. Why are they just sitting on them, and why is the CBD in every single gas station out there in Walgreens? But, you know, alcohol harms the liver, and they just sell that. And then tobacco is the number one preventable death reason for death in the United States, and that funds half the country with the tobacco taxes. So, yeah, the government does not really care about the health of people. They're here to facilitate capitalist system. And this, it seems like they, I think it's the scheduling, schedule one and all that. I kind of take the FDA's word for this, that they actually don't have the tools to do this, but they got Epidiolex out there, which is a corporate sort of brand of CBD.
Yeah.
Okay, so our next story is out of Oregon, and this is sort of part of the, some things we've been talking about recently, how the cannabis industry has been contracting, let's say, and but in this case, they're kind of using the contraction as an excuse to rip off a bunch of small farms in Oregon, and the name of the brand is Chalice Brands, and they're actually out of Canada. And they're just ripping these farms off down there, just not even answering their emails with the invoices for like $5,000 here, $10,000 here, adds up to about $100,000 across the board, which isn't a lot to a company. If you go over there and look at their books, they're up in the millions, $15 million profit. They have a lot of money over there at Chalice Brands, just ripping them off down there in Oregon, Dig.
Yeah, and that money may not be a big deal to Chalice Brands, but that could make a huge impact on payroll for these smaller dispensaries. They're, you know, their margins aren't always that great. But here's what I want to talk about. Chalice Brands was originally founded in Oregon, and then it was bought by a Canadian investment firm, and then now they're headquartered out of Oregon. So even if these businesses want to take them to small claims court in Oregon, they can't because they're a Canadian company. So how are they going to make them pay? And I would posit to the listeners, any of the listeners that work in this industry, to be careful doing business with international brands, because you may have no recourse if they decide that paying you for a service and stealing services and or product from you is a good business decision.
Yeah, they'd have to take that up to federal court, and it would add, those bills for just taking it to federal court would add up to more than what's owed. So,
well, yeah, and they can't take it to federal court because the federal court doesn't recognize cannabis as a legitimate business.
Yeah, there's not. Yeah, there's not really. And then, and now, and if the businesses go out of business, they can't declare bankruptcy. No. But you know, Chalice up in Canada, they're just continuing to do business. So just wanted to bring that to the audience's attention, how if you're in the cannabis industry, you need to be careful out there who you're working with. And if you're a consumer, as we've talked about plenty of times on the Cannabis Corner, make sure you're researching the brands that you are actually out there supporting.
Right.
Okay, so our last story, and this is an update and kind of a theme that we've talked about before, and this is an interesting story out of Missouri, because Missouri just passed legal cannabis, and this is something that is always keeps getting recycled. Every time a new state gets a legal recreational cannabis or adult-use cannabis, a newspaper or somebody runs stories like, how to consume cannabis, what do you need to do to consume cannabis, and this one's all about first-time cannabis consumers, and we kind of wanted to go over some tips that they had in the article, some good, some bad. And what was that first tip that they gave there, Dig?
The first one is they kind of go into assess your goals and why you're doing it and stuff, and like they go and they say there are more than 700 strains, they call them strains. We like cultivar here, but that's fine. They talk about sativa and indica, which is, you know, not 100% accurate, but I fall into this verbiage sometime because it's easy to kind of tell someone what effect they're looking for. But I would tell that novice users that it's going to be really subjective how cannabis affects you. It's completely different for everyone. And that's why I will often say that cannabis isn't for everyone. Some people are having an incredibly jarring experience when they consume cannabis. But another thing they say in this article, which is always accurate, is start low and go slow. I like to say colloquially, you can always smoke more, but you can never smoke less.
Yep.
You can always eat more, but you can never eat less.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was the best advice in the article. And one of the things I noticed in there was they were talking about how the first time you consume cannabis, you know, plan for it. And they said plan your entire day around it, which may, that's a lot. That's really difficult for a lot of people. But, you know, I would plan for it a little bit if it's going to be your first time consuming, especially if you have kids and things that you have to go do, because you don't want to consume your first joint at noon and then have to go pick your kids up at school. It's not going to work out very well for you because it's going to be, you don't want to drive after consuming if you even can drive, because like Dig said, it's going to be subjective. And just take it easy. You know, you don't want to necessarily, if your friend is a big smoker there, and they're like taking two or three bong rips, you don't need to try to keep up with that, because it's going to be difficult to handle the THC high, and especially if you're doing edibles. I would say,
I would strongly dis. Like, okay, so I know that smoking can be foul to some people. I know that it can have bad health consequences, but if you're only going to do it once and you're just trying it and getting a feel for cannabis, the health effects for inhaling a small amount of cannabis smoke one time are transitory. They're not really that bad. And I would suggest that the effect of smoked cannabis is so much more accessible and gentler high smokes. When you eat cannabis, it's processed through your liver, becomes a different chemical slightly, and it has a way more intense and unnerving effect on your brain, especially of new users. You can get used to it, but for a first-time user, I definitely suggest smoking or vaporization.
Yeah, so if you are a first-time cannabis user, it is something you want to put a little thought into, because I don't know how many people – I've talked to so many people, Dig, or like – I hate cannabis. I'm allergic to it. I don't like it because it was a little stronger than they might have thought, and they had a very negative experience. And I understand and really hope that that doesn't happen to people. So try to make sure to take it easy. And speaking of edibles, I just want to add more to this article. You can go read it. You can find the link at our blog, The Cannabis Corner 840.blogspot.com. I just wanted to add one more thing for first-time cannabis consumers. Make sure if you have kids that you have a plan to keep your cannabis out of the hands of your kids, because there's a big problem going on right now with kids consuming cannabis, and it's being used against the cannabis movement right now. They're bringing it up in that legislative hearing that I was just talking about with those other bills. There was the Hemp and Food Task Force bill, and they were saying bringing up these articles about kids consuming cannabis. So make sure if you're a first-time cannabis consumer that you have a plan to keep them out of the hands of your kids.
Yeah, you should do that.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
And we are back on the Cannabis Corner for this week's guest. And this week we are joined by Chuck Olivier. And Chuck is the owner-operator of Digital Balance Services here in Washington State. And he is here to talk to us about some things going on with weights and measurements out there in the cannabis industry. How's it going today, Chuck?
I'm doing great, and I'm very happy to be here. Very good to be here.
Yeah, great to have you on the show. And we have met and been working together in the Cannabis Alliance for a while. I wanted to have you on because I've heard a lot about the things you're talking about that are going on out here in this field. But before we get to that, tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get into cannabis weights and measures?
Oh, absolutely. So I've been a cannabis law reform activist my whole adult life. I'm a proud 25-year HempFest core staff member. And back in 2012, when we passed I-502, I was reading the law, and I noticed that it mentioned scales. Well, back in my 20s, I worked as a scale technician for a mainstream scale company, did a lot of grocery store work and warehouse work and some food processing work. So, and I enjoyed that job immensely. It just didn't pay enough. And so in 2012, when I realized that the newly created commercial cannabis industry was going to need a scale company, I decided to jump in. And it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, and I back in the day, we used to, when I would get cannabis, we used to weigh our cannabis with those old carburetor floats. I don't know about everybody else. I've
carburetor floats, that old postal scale.
Yeah, I've mentioned that to people, and they're like, what, carburetor floats? I'm like, yeah, that's how we used to weigh our cannabis. But I'm guessing cannabis weighing in the 502 in the legal industry has came a long way from some of that stuff. So just real quick, describe to us some of the things that you do out there in your daily job with weights and measurements in the cannabis industry.
Well, when I first walk into a cannabis cultivator or a packager, I inspect their whole weighing process. I look at how they use the scale, what kind of table is the scale sitting on, is there wind or drafts, and I check the power to make sure that the voltage coming in is not a problem. After I inspect the whole process, I'll test the scale itself with traceable test weights, see if it's within tolerances. If it's not, I'll calibrate the scale, and then it will be within tolerance. But a big part of what I do is educate the end users, the trimmers and the packagers, on how to properly use these really highly sensitive jewelry balances.
Interesting. So I know a lot has changed out there in the cannabis industry since 2012, and even when medical came on, these things have been changing. So what are some things that you have seen change since you began working in the weights and measures in the cannabis industry in 2012?
Oh, man, so much. I think the big thing would be mainstreaming. Back in 2012, when we started, when we really hit the road in 2013, 14, and 15, cannabis was brand new and very controversial and edgy, and most mainstream businesses wanted nothing to do with it. 10 years later, cannabis is mainstream. Everyone can talk about it. And now all kinds of professionals and businesses and consultants want to come into the cannabis space and try and do their profession and have a business. One thing that I've particularly noticed is that the regulators are now paying attention. Back when we started this ride in 2012, at least certainly here in Washington, Weights and Measures is run by the Department of Agriculture in the state of Washington. Hmm. They were 100% hands-off of cannabis when we passed I-502. They admit to this because they were afraid of losing their federal funding. Most state departments of agriculture who manage the weights and measures programs in most states are heavily reliant on federal funding, and they were super nervous that they were going to lose that if they participated in cannabis at all. 10 years later, federal weights and measures regulators are paying attention to our industry. We're in the billions now, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we will get into the federal regulation here in 1 minute, but I wanted to ask you a question about the traceability. We've covered on the show a fair amount about Washington State's traceability system and some of the issues that are going on with that. So can you tell the audience real quick, how does these weights and measurements and being accurate and everything being correct, how does that factor into our current traceability scheme we have in the state?
The first thing is statistics in general. When we talk about our production, when we talk about what we're doing, it's all based in weight. So it helps if those weights are accurate for all the statistics and data. But more specifically, what we're getting at is diversion. And so and potency as well. So if a lot of times when you go to a cannabis store in Washington, what you get is dry as a bone.
Mm-hmm.
And when cannabis is sent to the lab dry as a bone, it's going to test more potent because there's less water in it. An unscrupulous cultivator or packager could bring that back to their facility, expose it to some moisture. Now they have more mass to sell that's at a lower potency than what's on the label.
Hmm. So it's really important to have those measures correct and everybody recording everything correctly. And as you mentioned, the federal government is starting to take a closer look at this. So can you tell us real quick, we'll start, there's two cases of this that we were talking about before the show, and one of them is the National Type Evaluation Program, NTEP, is getting into the cannabis industry and starting to do some regulations. Tell us real quick about some of the inroads NTEP is making into the cannabis industry.
You bet. And NTEP is a testing laboratory, and they're part of a small group of federal agencies, including NIST, that handle commercial weighing devices and meters. So any scale that's used for buying or selling has to be NTEP approved. So that's your grocery store scale. That's a gas pump, a propane meter. And so when the scale manufacturer or meter manufacturer comes out with their new scale, they send it into NTEP, which is a testing laboratory. And they'll do things like, say it's a 10-pound scale. They'll weigh 5 pounds 100,000 times. The scale has to be dead on repeatable for those 100,000 weighings. And while that's going on, they'll expose it to cold and hot and fluctuations in its power supply. They'll unplug it during the test. And so what NTEP is doing is they want to determine accuracy, repeatability, and permanence or durability. When a scale is NTEP approved, we know that it's built solidly and will be accurate and repeatable throughout its design life.
And you were saying that a lot of the cannabis manufacturing devices out there are not NTEP approved.
That's correct.
What is this? What effect is this having in the cannabis industry?
Well, it's not having an effect yet. It's going to in a few years. So 10 years in, we're starting to see economies of scale happen, and smaller operators are needing automation to compete. The medium and large size operators are all, not all, but many are already using automation. And when I say automation, I mean bagging equipment, jar filling equipment to put the flower into jars, and joint making equipment. And some of these machines use a weighing module in that process, and none of those weighing modules are NTEP approved. So what that means is that the machine that's being used to package the retail packages that we buy has probably not been thoroughly tested past the manufacturer. NTEP is a big audit of your whole manufacturing process, and NTEP's process goes deeper than just the scale itself. I should mention that when you submit your scale to NTEP for approval, they're going to audit your whole manufacturing process documentation program. The manufacturers have to pull a certain amount of units out of the line every year and test those in their own internal labs. We really want all commercial waste to be done on NTEP scales, and right now, our industry doesn't have an NTEP-approved piece of automation equipment.
Yeah, it sounds like the cost can run up pretty quickly. And right now, a lot of those jobs as far as weighing the joints and filling the jars, they're all done by people or trimmers, right?
Well, they're supposed to. So every joint is supposed to be weighed on that jewelry balance.
Yeah.
Every bag and jar of flour and vape cart and puck of dabs is supposed to be weighed on a jewelry balance. Most aren't.
So you mentioned the NIST, the National Institute of Science and Technology, and they are also starting to make some inroads into the cannabis industry and starting to pay attention a little bit more. So tell us about some of the happenings going on with this federal agency.
Sure. So NIST is America's measurement laboratory, and they maintain the federal weights and measures standards, and they publish the uniform weights and measures law that most states, including Washington, just promulgate into their own regulations, making the NIST handbooks the law in that state. So the NTEP portion of the weights and measures equation is handled in NIST Handbook 44, which is all about scales and how they're designed. Another handbook published by NIST is Handbook 130. And most anybody who packages anything is very familiar with Handbook 130 because that's what lays out the uniform packaging regulation. This is why when you go into a grocery store, the weight statement is always on the bottom of the package or in some other places due to that part. I'm not going to get into that. That's complicated, the packaging labeling law. You can get variances. But the reason consumer packages all look pretty much the same as far as consumer information goes is Handbook 130. The other thing that Handbook 130 lays out is the uniform law, right? And effective this year, 2023, Handbook 130, the word cannabis arrives. And now state weights and measures officials in states with regulated programs have authority over potency, moisture content, water activity, and packaging and labeling. And where this kind of makes sense is in most states, it's your weights and measures department that checks gasoline for octane and motor oil for viscosity. And now they have the authority to check cannabis for weight, moisture content, and potency.
Yeah, and you were just talking about how those three things can have a big effect on what kind of product you buy. What effect do you think this will have for consumers, good and bad?
On the good side, all of the entire supply chain is going to have to tighten up, get better scales, packaging is something that's going to come into play. So here in Washington, when you walk into the pot shop, it usually smells like raw cannabis. It's really not supposed to, right?
Right.
If you can smell those terps, they're coming out of those packages along with moisture and everything else. Mm-hmm. So we will probably need to tighten up our packaging materials. So for the good of the consumer, better packaging, better maintenance of the product, better scales being used for the process. What could be bad for the consumer is an increase in price as those cultivators and packagers passed on the increased cost of better scales calibrated in place and serviced yearly, as well as whatever we need to do with our packaging to comply with a newly expanded set of regulatory eyes looking at the packaging, as well as preventing moisture loss and maintaining water activity.
Yeah, that is something I've always remarked on when I'm going into the cannabis store, is how you can smell the cannabis. And I do remember back when they made the laws governing our 502 and our medical cannabis laws, the 5052, that was a big deal that they did not want people to smell the cannabis. That was huge. And now, I was just in Vancouver, Washington, a couple of weeks ago, and we got out of our hotel, and I'm like, wow, the whole place smells like skunk, which doesn't bother me. But I've always found it fascinating how you can't smell your cannabis in the store before you buy it, but the store smells like cannabis, and in some parts of the state, the whole area smells like cannabis. So it's a fascinating thing we have going on here with this packaging issue.
Yep. And now state weights and measures regulators, in addition to the cannabis regulatory agencies, now have something to say about that packaging. We'll see if they do. Vary state by state, of course. But what all this means for operators, licensees, is it's time to start stepping up and get ahead of this. You got a couple of years, but it's time to pay attention.
So what are some things that are on the horizon coming up with weights and measures? I know you mentioned a couple, but do you have any other things that you think that are exciting or might be affecting consumers coming up in this on this topic?
Consumers, as far as we're concerned, the things that Weights and Measures is paying attention to is the moisture content, and they're talking about allowing a 3% variance in weight based on moisture loss. They're talking about storage of cannabis all throughout the supply chain, having that stored at 0.55 to 0.65 water activity all through the supply chain from grower to seller. And that comes to about 10 or 12% moisture content, which is what we're used to. The other big thing that could happen is a change in labeling, where we, instead of seeing a THC percentage on the label, we see milligrams of THC in this bag to include flower. Mm. So dosage-based versus percentage-based labeling for potency. And, of course, the rise of automation equipment, particularly with joint making, that's a very labor-intensive process. And you got to turn out a lot of joints. Joints are climbing rapidly in volume of total sales, I think a lot related to the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So the half gram, the dog walkers are super popular right now, and you got to make them by the millions. So anybody who wants to compete is going to need to buy automation equipment, joint making machines and bagging machines.
Yeah, I do hemp processing. One of the things we do is a machine that rolls joints, and it is a very labor intensive process and takes a long time. Mm-hmm. And to make money off of it, like you said, you're going to have to make a lot of them. And so it's really interesting to hear how this automation is coming on board. But they're going to have to all be NTEP approved, which, as you said, will start to raise the price on some of those.
Right. And there's people working in the space right now to get that done. But again, the price of the machine will double after when an NTEP approved machine arrives on the market, you're compelled to use it.
Yeah.
Right. Because now you know this machine is NTEP approved and this machine is not.
Right. Yeah. One more question. And I just wanted this for the audience and myself. Do you have any insight of why a ounce of cannabis is 28 grams? But an actual ounce out there in weights and measurements is 32.
Oh, you're kidding.
And what does NTEP say about that?
So choose one or the other, right? But yet all are acceptable. So this is a funny thing about cannabis. And so we go from pounds and ounces to grams and kilos in the same conversation back and forth.
Yeah.
Right. And it's that when I first started in cannabis versus mainstream scales, it was funny. Everybody talking about the 448 gram pound.
Yeah.
Right. And no, cannabis is 28 and a half grams. It's because we talk about cannabis in fractions of an ounce,
mm-hmm.
or, in fractions of a pound, but we measure it in grams.
Yes.
And so it's something we've created ourselves. It's a funny part of our world. And what I would like to see is us just go to grams.
Right.
And end the 28. Yeah. So you're calling it an ounce, but it's not really an ounce.
Yeah. Yeah. Because a quarter is a quarter of an ounce, which is a 16th of a pound, which is 7 grams. None of those match up.
No, and we did it to ourselves, and it's kind of funny. And one thing that it makes me smile when I'm out in the field is hearing people at the cultivators talking about pricing and such, going back and forth from pounds to grams in the same conversation. I'm the scale man, and I'm not that sharp. I use a unit converter whenever I have these conversations.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate that. It's something I actually did not know that until a couple of years ago. I was doing some research, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And before we get out of here, tell us how people can get in touch with you and find out more about your work.
DigitalBalanceServices.com is a great place to check me out.
All right. Thanks, Chuck.
Thank you so much, Lucas. Talk to you soon.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by Advocates for Medical Cannabis. Learn more about this organization at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com.
And now on to the final segment of the show, and that is our It's a Bust segment. And this is a point where we talk about the drug war and what's still going on out there with people getting arrested for cannabis. And this one comes out of Oklahoma, where we have heard for years that the cannabis market is booming, and it still is booming, and they got a recreational, they have an adult use initiative coming up at some point. And this poor guy got pulled over at a traffic stop, and he was caught with, what was it, 160 pounds of cannabis?
Yeah, it was a lot of cannabis. And he had a little bit of cannabis up front that he'd spilled on the front of his car. And they searched it, and they found that whole stash. And I would tell people, like, we don't know the whole story here, but this is really unfortunate for that guy because he didn't have the proper licensing to transport that cannabis. So he could be looking at a lot of time, and that's really unfortunate.
Yeah, because they're really trying to crack down on the underground market there in Oklahoma. And, yeah, somebody could even given it to him and said, here, take this over here. Can you do me a favor? I mean, who knows? But it's just, we're still going on with this pulling people over and people getting arrested. And that's how it happens. Like, oh, well, you took a left turn when you should have put your blinker on going right or whatever it is. I don't drive, so I don't know all the laws. But they try to get in to check you out. Oh, what's that spilled there on your console? Oh, some weed. So then they search you, and then there you go, 160 pounds. So 167 pounds, which in Oklahoma, I mean, to just us cannabis consumers, that seems like a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, and there's all kinds of scales to this. As a home grower, you know, I'm probably producing like 1 to 6 pounds yearly, right? I'm not producing that much cannabis. Enough for me, for sure, and to share with my friends, but not enough, you know, to sell a pound to anyone or anything like that. So to me, that's a lot of cannabis. But if you're moving that across the state, he could have been part of the legal market, but just not had his paperwork with him. That's another thing you got to consider. Like, there's, if you don't have your paperwork with you, you're not legal.
So yeah, we hope this works out down there in Oklahoma. And I want to thank the guests for coming on today, and thank everybody out there listening here in Tacoma and online. And I want to thank you, Dig, for being on the show. I hope you have a great week.
Hey, you too. See you next week.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support. I'd also like to thank Aaron Foles for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on The Cannabis Corner.